This is a poem, okay? There are people who treat this passage as if it were a scientific treatise, but it's not. There are people who treat this passage as if it is a doctrinal or theological treatise. It is not, although it does have theological implications. This is a poem. Nancy and I just read portions of the poem, but you'll notice even in those portions that there were a lot of repeated words and phrases. That's a part of Hebrew poetry. Let me encourage you, read the whole poem. Not necessarily right now. When you get home, read the whole poem. Because when you do, you will see that those repetitions mean that instead of the paragraphs that are in the Bible, this could be read as if it were a series of stanzas. This is poetry. Okay? And so if the scientific story of creation tells us the what and the how of creation, this poem tells us the who and the why. And there's no real conflict between them. This poem tells us about who created the earth, why the earth was created, and that everything that God made is good. Now, when you start looking at the elements of this particular story, you see that on every single day when God says, it is good, God is not saying, oh, I've made it, now I'm going to proclaim it good. No. No, God makes it, speaks it into being, looks at it and says, wow, this is good. Like a child playing with Play-Doh, you know, and that dinosaur turns out really well, better than they expected, and they think, ooh, this is good. Or a preacher preparing for a sermon and a phrase comes along and he or she didn't even think about it before they got up, but it was just right. And it kind of startles us. We say, whoa, whoa, that's good. God speaks the world into being and sees it and declares that it is good. God has seen that it is good. I know I walk through most of my life not seeing what I look at. You know, even with these beautiful stained glass windows, I'll come in here and I won't even really notice as I look at them unless I take time to pay attention. Sometimes the people who are closest to me, the people I love the most, I look at them, but I don't really see them. I can take a hike out at Edwin Warner Park or one of the other parks around. I'm walking through nature, but I'm thinking about what I'm going to say to you on Sunday, and I don't even see that stuff, which is kind of a shame. Because you see, before you can recognize that something is good, you have to be able to see it. That's what God did. God saw the creation and saw that it was good. In fact, on the third day, God said twice, it is good. That's why it's particularly fortunate and blessed to do something on a Tuesday, which is the third day of the week. It's called the twice blessed in the Jewish tradition. At the end of everything, God looks at all of it, even the creepy, crawly critters that you're afraid of, that get into your house that you don't want in your house, and God says, this is very good. Sometimes, however, we kind of lose the ability to see, and in losing the ability to see, we lose the ability to recognize that something is very good. This poem helps us regain that, reminds us to glimpse the world through the eyes of God. And when we see the world through the eyes of God, we see the goodness of it. Now, one of the problems we have in the modern world is that sometimes we even forget that all of this creation belongs to God in the first place. We think it belongs to us. We think this is ours to do with as we want without regard to any of the consequences. Now, we're going to be talking throughout Easter about creation care. How do we care for this creation God has given us? Before you can care for it, you have to know that it's good. Before you can know that it's good, you have to be able to see it. And when the day is done, we have to recognize that it doesn't belong to us. My grandfather was a tenant farmer. My father grew up as a young child, moving from farm to farm to farm. He was taken out of school in the fourth grade so he could work. Because, you see, they did not own the land. They worked. They worked for other people who thought they owned the land. But the truth of the matter is, those folks didn't even own the land, even though they had all the legal documents. Because, you see, the land is a gift from God. The idea that we are anything more than tenants, all of us, working somebody else's land, is a misreading of this poem, is a misunderstanding of the Jewish and Christian tradition. So how do you respond differently if you believe that you are taking care of something that someone has given you in order to pass it along to another generation than you do when you look at something and say, well, it's mine. I can do with it what I want to. I can tear it up if I want to. I can ruin it if I want to. Well, think of this church. In a few minutes, we're going to offer a prayer over those who will be leading us in a capital campaign. You'll hear more about that in the future. But I didn't build this church. Some of you were here when it was built, but most of you weren't. We received this church as a gift. So the question is, does it belong to me? Is this my church and I can do whatever I want to, even if it goes to rack and ruin? Of course not. That would be madness for me to think that. This church is entrusted to this generation in order to care for it so we can pass it along to the next generation. The same is true of the earth. It is a gift. We didn't create it. We didn't deserve it. But God called it good. And we have to treat it as if it is a good gift, not just for some, but for all. When I was a young boy, before I was about 6 years old, there was a scourge, a great fear that went through this country and much of the world that was equal to that fear of the nuclear threat that we talked about so much. It's called polio. Some of you remember that. People wouldn't let their kids go swim in public pools for fear that they would contract polio. There was a young Jewish doctor, first-generation son of immigrants living in New York, educated at the City College of New York, which was one of those institutions created specifically to educate immigrant people, folks who couldn't afford to go to college otherwise. And you have Pulitzer Prize winners. You have scientists who have developed all kinds of wonderful, wonderful things for us to keep us healthy. Well, he was one of those. He went to medical school. He showed that he had a real capability to do research, and he had a drive to see if he could develop a vaccine from a dead virus. Now, people had developed vaccines from live viruses. He wanted to develop a vaccine to prevent polio from a dead polio virus, so there would not be any chance that you would contract the disease from the vaccination. In 1957, he succeeded. I took that shot. Anybody else? Yeah. Yeah, that's probably why we're still sitting here, many of us. Jonas Salk was his name. He was a kind of private guy. He was kind of shy, did not like the spotlight, but as soon as he made this discovery and it was known, he was in the spotlight. He was interviewed by Edward R. Murrow, one of the great journalists of that age. Murrow said, well, tell me, who owns the patent? To which Jonas Salk responded, there's no patent. You can't patent the sun. He could have patented it. He could have been a multi-billionaire if he had wanted to. Now, he did okay, you know? But he could have been wealthy beyond our imagination. But he thought it was more important that people have access to this vaccine than that he be a multibillionaire. He understood this poem. He understood this story. He had not created the viruses he worked with. He had simply manipulated them. He had modified them so that they could help people. And if he was going to help people, he was going to help as many people as possible. I think Jonas Salk, this young Jewish doctor, had a really good grasp of what the poet is saying here. Somewhere along the way, though, we lost that in part of our culture and part of our experience. Back in the early 1800s, for example, it was the policy of the United States government to ask military personnel who were stationed around the world and ambassadors and other folks who were stationed around the world to bring back seeds because they wanted to be able to have as wide a variety of crops within the United States as they possibly could. It just seemed to make sense. After all, in the story you heard Nancy and me read, there's a great mention of seeds. God gives seed-bearing plants fruit with seeds in it. Mentions that a couple of times, actually, as a gift to humanity. After this country was devastated by a war in which we fought each other, in 1865, the government decided to give out seeds, to give them away to farmers. And they encouraged them to save those seeds for the next year. Now, that wasn't anything new. People had been saving seeds since there was agriculture, since the first person had planted a plant and saved it. My mother saved seeds for our garden from what we had grown. It was a foolish farmer who would eat his seed corn. Let me tell you. But then things started to change. In 1930, somebody decided that you could actually, if you manipulated, if you tinkered with and modified a seed, you could own it. You could patent it. First one kind of seed, and then a little bit later, another. And by the 1970s, you could patent any seed that you had modified in any way. Now, there had been modifications before. People had come up with different hybrids, and those had been shared, and it enriched the whole of our food supply. But now that seed belonged to that particular company. There was a provision in there, however, that if you save seed and you're a farmer, that's okay. You can save seed. You just have to buy it the original time from the person or company who patented it. But then through a series of lawsuits, it was decided that no, you couldn't. That anyone who owned the patent on a seed, the seeds God put in the fruit, the seeds that God put in the vegetables for everyone, if someone manipulated a seed in exactly the same way as Jonas Salk manipulated a virus and modified it, they could patent it, and you could not save the seed. Today, if you buy seed from Monsanto and you save it, they will sue you. They will take your farm. You don't even have to buy seeds from them. No, if you grow organic soybeans next to soybeans that had been purchased from the company, and through that process of germination and growing, some aspects of those soybeans get into your soybeans, though you never bought a seed, they will sue you, they will take your farm. Because you see, you can patent the sun. Or some people think so. I think that's a terrible misreading of this story. I think Jonas Salk got it right. God put the various creatures, the various parts of creation here on earth for the good of all, so that everyone would have enough. If he made a discovery that helped the world, it belonged to the world. I think it is a serious misreading to say if I make a discovery that belongs to the world, it belongs to me. That is saying that this is not a gift from God. I made it. I am God. A kind of hubris that is at the center of every single Greek tragedy. That's why it's called tragedy. Because the consequences are terrible. How do we begin to glimpse the world through the eyes of God? Not to think that we are God, but to be able to see the creation in such a way that we can see its goodness. See it as a gift that we are caretakers of, to pass along to anyone who needs it, to the next generation or this generation. Anybody know anyone who suffers from polio today? If so, they got it before 1957. You see what you can do when you don't try to patent the sun? The good gifts of God belong to all of us. They belong to all of us because God gave them to us, created them and gave them to us, placed them in our care so that they might benefit everyone. Go read the poem. Go read this poem. That's what it says. God saw everything that God had created, and indeed, it was very good. Amen.